start the first case today, Mulder versus State. Justice Perigary very shortly will be appearing on camera from Carson City. Justice Cherry not participating on the first case. He had something to do at the lower courts with this particular matter. And Justice Gibbons is not available today, but will be participating after reviewing the tape of the oral arguments, and Justice Perigary is with us at this point. So, Ms. Farley, on behalf of Mr. Mulder, if you're ready to proceed, please do so. If you wish to reserve any time, please so state.
May it please the Court. My name is Heather Fraley, and I represent the appellant, Michael Mulder. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. In 2001, a mere 2 months after counsel was appointed to represent Mr. Mulder in his first state post-conviction proceeding, he suffered a massive stroke. As a result of the stroke, Mr. Mulder is functionally intellectually disabled. He has huge gaps in memory related to his trial, his crime, and his life. His speech is slow and labored, and he often can't speak the words that his brain wishes to communicate. In addition to these cognitive deficits, Mr. Mulder suffers from partial paralysis of the right side of his body, and his right arm is so severely constricted that with a continued lack of treatment, his wrist will eventually snap. As a result of these physical and mental disabilities that have plagued Mr. Mulder for the past 17 years, he is ineligible for the death penalty and can overcome the procedural defaults that are asserted by the state. As this court is aware, in Atkins versus Virginia, the Supreme Court held that it was unconstitutional to execute individuals with intellectual disability.
As to that point, there may be a distinction, and if you'll talk about it a little bit, between death penalty at this point versus being found eligible for it at the time of trial, since the disability that you're talking about is something that occurred later.
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Mulder's disability did occur after his trial. But the question before this court today, Your Honor, is whether the Eighth Amendment permits his execution given his current situation. And our position is that it doesn't. And that, again, the court in Atkins said can't execute individuals with intellectual disability. But the court in that case left it to the states to define what that means and how that would be implemented. In the wake of Atkins, many states, including Nevada, established bright-line rules for defining what intellectual disability means for the purposes of death eligibility. But the Supreme Court in Hall said that the establishment of such bright-line rules for determining whether someone is or isn't eligible for the death penalty under Atkins is inappropriate, and that the more appropriate course for the courts is to look to the Eighth Amendment to determine whether there's a legitimate peniological justification behind executing a particular individual. And the factors that the courts are to look to in establishing that peniological justification are: what does the medical community say about what intellectual disability means? What does the society at large say, the legal community, the medical community, about whether there's an emerging consensus against executing a particular category of individuals? In addition, when we look to legitimate peniological interest, we look to whether executing someone serves any legitimate deterrent or retributive value. And, Your Honors, in this case, all of those factors weigh against finding Mr. Mulder eligible for the death sentence. So the reason that we can demonstrate good cause for raising this allegation of ineligibility at this time is because Mr. Mulder tried to do that before. And this court applied precisely the bright-line rule, a similar kind of bright-line rule that the court in Hall said is inappropriate. This court held that because Mr. Mulder's deficits did not begin during the developmental period, that he was not eligible for relief under Atkins. But Hull makes clear that the courts aren't supposed to apply such bright-line rules, and you're supposed to look to these other factors. So when you look to these other factors, first, is there a legitimate peniological justification behind executing Mr. Mulder?
Let me inquire, though, counsel. How do we deal with the court's finding in 2005, which is after the stroke, of competence?
Your Honor, the claims that were raised by First State Post-Conviction Counsel were entirely record-based. He raised allegations of trial counsel ineffectiveness that were clear from the record, and he raised some jury instructional error claims and some just general challenges to the legitimacy of the death penalty in this country. The court found that Mr. Mulder was competent at that time because post-conviction counsel failed to show how Mr. Mulder's assistance was necessary to raise those claims. The claims in the instant petition, however, did necessitate Mr. Mulder's assistance and continue to necessitate his assistance because they rely on evidence that's outside of the record.
And what specifically are those claims?
Well, specifically, Your Honor, the allegation that trial counsel was ineffective for failing to investigate and present sufficient mitigating evidence. Developing and presenting such a claim requires the assistance of
the court. What specific mitigating evidence? Well, not just a general field. That covers a lot of ground.
So, well, specifically in this case, Your Honor, post-conviction counsel met with Mr. Mulder one time for 10 minutes. So he didn't even try to talk to Mr. Mulder about his life or his trial or anything that happened at his trial. We know from the assessments that were conducted both in state and federal court that Mr. Mulder doesn't remember large portions of his life and his trial. He doesn't remember killing the victim in this case. And so it was impossible for post-conviction counsel to get some of that information out of him. Even the information that Mr. Mulder could communicate, post-conviction counsel failed to talk to him about that information.
We have a record that, and you'll disagree with part of it, but the record seems to establish that there's a difference as to what Mr. Mulder remembers depending on who he's talking to. There were some people in the prisons, the guards, and some other individuals who tended to say he was very conversational at different points. One doctor said he was conversational, some other doctors said he wasn't. What is your response as to those particular facts in the record?
Your Honor, as to the employees of the prison, the record is clear and those individuals admitted that they never had anything more than the most basic conversations with Mr. Mulder. For example, about his needs for food or new
socks. But there's allegations in the record that I guess, and you pointed those out, that he was not able to complete simple sentences, but yet we have others that say, yes, he could. He interchanged without problem.
Your Honor, I believe all of the experts that have testified both in state and federal court in this case agree that Mr. Mulder suffers from expressive aphasia. They all agree.
I'm not sure where that they all agree. I think there was a slight divergence, but go ahead with your argument.
Your Honor, they certainly disagreed on the extent to which he could communicate certain kinds of information. But they all agreed that he suffered from brain damage as a result of the stroke, and that even Dr. Bishop and Dr. Bradley, who had testified for the state, and arguably they had the most damaging testimony for Mr. Mulder, even those individuals agreed that he suffered from cognitive deficits and that he suffered from difficulty communicating. It is true that the doctor said that with time, with effort, he could at times find different words to replace for the words that his mouth couldn't speak, that he at times could remember certain things, and that is true. But the point is that post-conviction counsel didn't spend that time. He spent 10 minutes with Mr. Mulder. He didn't even try. Nor did he attempt, Your Honors, to discover information that was available without Mr. Mulder's assistance. For example, talking to family members, obtaining records. Post-conviction counsel didn't do any of those things. So Mr. Mulder's failure to raise allegations of ineffective assistance of trial counsel during the first state post-conviction proceeding are attributable largely to post-conviction counsel's ineffectiveness in failing to investigate and in failing to even try to get Mr. Mulder's assistance.
Ms. Frawley, it's not clear to me from the record if counsel had proceeded down that course, what would they have found? What information would have come forward that would have changed this outcome?
So some examples of some information, and to get back again to Your Honor's question, have to do, for example, with his communications with trial counsel, which we still struggle to get much of anything about Mr. Mulder in that regard, and has been hindered in that way. But for example, trial counsel, Mr. Mulder didn't allocute. Mr. Mulder didn't talk to the experts about physical abuse that we now know that he suffered pretty severely as a child. He didn't talk to them about his siblings' severe alcohol and drug addiction, which allowed the state to argue that Mr. Mulder was the only one of his five siblings that had any problems, and we know that that is not true. So we've been unable to talk to Mr. Mulder about whether he communicated those things to trial counsel, whether trial counsel even asked those questions. And getting to what physical abuse occurred, the addictions of his family members, took a lot longer in this case because Mr. Mulder wasn't able to tell us, here's what happened, here's who knows about those things that happened. It required us to basically do a dry run of investigation and simply try to locate these people and see what they had to say. So where normally you can get the information from your client, go talk to the individuals, have some sense of what those individuals are going to say, we haven't had that, Your Honor. We've had to find that out for the first instance on our own. In addition, there are some individuals who knew Mr. Mulder in the past who could have provided compelling testimony at trial, and we didn't find out about these individuals even until 2014. So there was a young girl who whose mother Mr. Mulder had dated prior to the instant offense. Her name was Kelly Lohman. And her declaration talks about how much Mr. Mulder took care of her and protected her from other individuals that were hanging around with her mother at the time. Such testimony would have been compelling to rebut the state's argument that Mr. Mulder was this hardened criminal, that he posed a future danger, and that there was nothing that could have mitigated his posing of a future danger. Somebody like Kelly Lohman's testimony would have been critical to show that when Mr. Mulder was not deep in the throes of his addiction, which being in prison would have assisted in some regard with that he was a good person, that he was a helpful person. In addition, there's an individual named Ed Barger, who could have talked about Mr. Mulder's physical abuse that he suffered as a child, again, which the jury heard nothing about. All the jury heard was that there was a potential of emotional abuse, but there was no physical abuse. And so there are these individuals who could have rebutted the state's argument regarding future dangerousness, and we were not able to locate those individuals until we spent a significant amount of time working with Mr. Mulder to try to get that information. I see that I have a little bit less than 5 minutes, Your Honors, if I might reserve that time for my rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Owens, on behalf of the state.
Thank you. May it please the court, I'm Steve Owens, Clark County District Attorney's Office, on behalf of the respondent, State of Nevada. I disagree with counsel's framing of the issue, if I understood her correctly, which was that whether the Eighth Amendment renders the defendant ineligible or incompetent for purposes of execution. To me, that issue cannot be raised here in habeas. You can't hijack a habeas proceeding, which can only attack the judgment of conviction, to litigate whether or not he's sane for purposes of execution. In the same way, the federal public defender in another case before this court in Dozier has hijacked a habeas proceeding to try to litigate the execution protocols. Neither issue has anything to do with the judgment. Instead, the issue here is whether his state of mind, his incompetence, constitutes good cause to come back when they did in an untimely successive habeas petition. And to that end, I would say that absolutely not. There's no right to competence. His competence doesn't explain in any way, shape, or form the delay in coming back here. That was the 5 years they spent in federal court was of the federal public defender's choosing. They have long said that they needed time in federal court to research and get facts outside the record, that to be a competent federal habeas counsel, they need to do all this extensive outside-the-record investigation, which is why they delay in coming back to state court. I say nonsense. Now I've got U.S. Supreme Court authority to back me up. In Ryan v. Gonzalez, U.S. Supreme Court said that it's the role of federal habeas counsel in 2254 petitions, primarily record-based. Okay? Just look in the record. If they just raised what they did at state court, then the case would proceed, and we would have some capital litigants that actually exhaust all the remedies and have a ruling on the merits in federal court. They don't want that. U.S. Supreme Court's recognized that capital litigants are different. They have an incentive to delay. So they do their out-of-the-record investigation to delay the proceeding. They have to come up with something new in the federal case so that they get the stay-in-abeyance order to come back and exhaust additional state claims. And then we play this game just going back and forth between state and federal court 2, 3, sometimes 4 times, spinning our wheels. And that's why Coley said that pursuit of federal remedies is not good cause to delay coming into state court. This court years ago, against my advice, rejected the U.S. Supreme Court's relation back doctrine in Mail v. Felix. That was a U.S. Supreme Court case. This court said it in Powell and also in Barnhart, said that you can file a petition in state court and stop the time bars, and any supplement that you file thereafter, even if it's an entirely new claim that you've just discovered and investigated in state court, you can raise that without fear of having to violate any time or procedural bars. Your claims don't have to relate back to your timely filed petition. So the investigation that they did during 5 years in federal court should have been done in state court. That's the path this court has gone down. I don't like it, but they don't take advantage of that. They do their investigation outside, they delay, and they only come back once they've got all their ducks in a row, and then they dump this this petition on us. So his incompetence has nothing to do with the good cause for that delay. Maybe they need his mental abilities to investigate his life and more mitigation evidence. That's on the merits of the claims. We're not here on the merits of any of his claims. We're here on whether or not there was good cause for that five-year delay. Federal public defender represented this defendant throughout. They chose the federal public or the federal forum. They filed his habeas petition. They filed everything for him. They filed his state habeas petition. They've done it all for him, and so they've got no one but themselves to look for this this good cause that under state law they need to come up with. And certainly the defendant's competence might be relate to whether or not they can develop prejudice or the merits of their claims, but it's not going to help them on their good cause allegations, which is why the judge below in this case didn't reach the prejudice as an alternative argument. So soundly were they defeated on good cause, there was no need to alternatively make a decision on whether or not he could show prejudice. All of their avenues of good cause have failed. So that was incompetence, and mental deficits did not constitute good cause. Ineffective assistance of first post-conviction counsel. Well, years ago in Ripo, this court said that it would be 1 year from issuance of remitter following the appeal from the denial of first habeas. I assume that's still going to be good law at some point. Ripo has been sent back on certiorari on a different issue. Assuming that that rule of Ripo survives, they spent 5 years in federal court. They did not get back within 1 year of issuance of that remitter. Since the Ripo case, certainly they have gotten back. It shows that they can get back within 1 year, and they wait to that very last day, and then they file in state court, and that has been significant in speeding up the habeas proceedings. But this is one of the older cases. They had several others where they delayed for 5, sometimes 10 years in federal court. I think that rule of Ripo, I argued against it, but I think that rule of Ripo did bring some efficiency to the system and some certainty, and would remove an issue I wouldn't even have to argue about if it was reinstated. They certainly haven't met that. They didn't get back within 1 year. Hall v. Florida, mental retardation or intellectual disability requires onset before age 18, and we've got a clear case here. They cannot meet that standard. They admit they cannot meet that standard. To my knowledge, no court anywhere has held that mere mental deficiency or aphasia short of intellectual disability is going to exclude you from the death penalty. You have to have it occur before you attain maturity. That's why it stunts your growth, and so you are morally less culpable than someone who developed fully as an adult, went to prison, and chose to use drugs. That was the founding in this case. Chose to use drugs on death row in prison and had a stroke from it. They were bad drugs, had a stroke, and so he's his own cause of whatever mental deficiencies he has. That is someone less culpable than a child that has a birth defect. It was never developed properly to begin with. So the whole rationale under Atkins just doesn't fly. Their new case of Hall v. Florida really just said that Florida had this bright line rule of IQ had to be 70 or lower. And if you didn't meet that IQ, then you couldn't proceed any further with your claim. U.S. Supreme Court in Hall v. Florida said no. You can't have just this bright line. You have to look at all the factors together. And they cited several states that did not have a cutoff, and Nevada was one of them. And they cited us approvingly and said states like Nevada simply say you have to have this significant intellectual shortcoming that is no IQ cutoff. And so we're following the correct U.S. Supreme Court law. What it may be in the future, I don't know where they're going with this, who may have claims to exclude them from the death penalty, but we're not there yet, and you don't create new law in a procedurally barred successive habeas case. So if the law is going to change, and it does change, that needs to happen in some other case, and then we can talk about whether it's retroactively applicable to Mr. Mulder. And whether or not he's competent to be executed is an entirely different issue. There is no imminent execution date. There's a separate procedure in NRS 176.425 for how you go about challenging sanity to be executed. We just aren't there yet. You can't raise that in habeas. The alleged Brady, the institutional limitations of the Special Public Defender's Office, they claim they just fortuitously came across this when they saw affidavits in other cases from some of the attorneys in that office who said, hey, our caseload was really high. The ones who obtained those affidavits was the Special Public Defender's, or I'm sorry, was the Federal Public Defender's Office. They obtained those affidavits in 2007 in another case. That was Sheik's affidavit, 2007 in the Gregory Leonard case. They got it. Now they want to use it here some 10 years, well, I guess by the time they filed their petition here, some 7, 8 years later, they want to use that and say, well, that's good cause. We just discovered this. No, you developed those facts. Similarly, with Nancy Lemke and Pete LaPorta's affidavit, that was taken from the McKenna case. That was the Federal Public Defender's case, and they obtained those affidavits in July 8, 2011. Furthermore, the Special Public Defender's caseload is a matter of public record. They simply just looked at some of their other cases and said, hey, we alleged that over there. We can allege it here. That's not good cause.
Mr. Owen, is that truly Brady?
No, there's nothing I withheld. They're claiming that the Special Public Defender is a state actor and withheld that. I don't know that they were withholding anything. You have to go ask them, what was your caseload? And they disclose it. I don't see them as withholding anything. You know, is it incumbent on them to volunteer their caseload? Does that create some sort of per se exculpatory claim? I see it as just another variety of ineffective assistance of counsel. Whether it's a special PD or appointed counsel, it's appointed by the government. You can't turn all defense attorneys into government actors for purposes of Brady. They also alleged that we withheld information regarding this Van Heusen, defendant's girlfriend, that she changed her story, that we withheld notes. I've never seen any notes. There's no indication that there are notes. They've got a police report that documents in detail how she gave one statement and then she gave another just before going to the grand jury, and all that's documented in a police report that's single-spaced and 4 pages long. They've got that. And it's sheer speculation on their part to say that there's something else out there that warrants her change of testimony. They admitted in the arguments in lower court that they've talked to her about why she changed her mind. And they can also talk to the detective about whether he read Miranda from a card or from memory. In the police report, it says he Mirandized her. So just because they have further questions doesn't mean that there is some sort of Brady information, exculpatory material evidence that has been withheld from them in the state's file. I believe that is all their claims of good cause. And so there's just like 4 or 5 of them there. And that's why by the time we get to a successive petition filed this many years late, we don't need to go in as an alternative basis and look at all the prejudice of their many claims. It's a voluminous petition. But the way that in which they write their briefs, which this court has noted in other cases, and which I'm hoping will get published, they only spend 2 or 3 pages at the very front of that brief explaining their good cause for coming back into state court. They allege all claims herein are attributable to the ineffective assistance of first post-conviction counsel. And then they go into the substance of all their claims, and they directly challenge trial counsel's ineffectiveness. They directly challenge Brady claims without tying it to the good cause for the delay. And so it's very difficult. It shifts the burden to the prosecution and the judge below to make sense out of this voluminous brief that they file, or their thick opening brief in this case that this court has to sort through. But when you boil it down, if they can't prove one of those 4 avenues of good cause, then the petition's denied. Just like in Strickland, they have to show deficient performance and prejudice, and a failure on either prong is fatal to their claim. You don't have to go look at the other prong if they have failed on one. So too is it with our procedural bars and good cause of prejudice. I think I've said everything I wanted to. Are there any questions?
Before you sit down, Justice Perry in Carson City, any questions from you as to?
No, thank you.
And likewise, colleagues on the bench here in Las Vegas, any additional questions? Mr. Owens, thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Fraley, I'm sorry I mispronounced your name the first time.
No problem, Your Honor.
Your Honors, the state talks about how habeas is supposedly record-based and backward-looking, and that our office allegedly does all this extra record investigation simply for the purpose of delay. This court in NECA held and acknowledged that state post-conviction is, by definition, an extra record proceeding. Direct appeals are about raising claims on the record. Post-conviction is about raising claims outside of the record, which is why the court held in NECA that post-conviction counsel needs time to conduct investigation. The reason the Supreme Court held in Ryan versus Gonzalez that federal habeas is record-based and backward-looking is precisely because the federal courts assume that the state courts are providing litigants with a full and fair opportunity to litigate their claims. That's why it's backward-looking. The federal court says the state court is letting them develop these facts. And in this case, Mr. Mulder did not have that opportunity due to a combination of his post-conviction counsel's failure to conduct any investigation, to even attempt to elicit information out of Mr. Mulder, and Mr. Mulder's incompetence. So even though federal habeas might be backward-looking, that's because state habeas isn't supposed to be. And in this case, Mr. Mulder didn't have the opportunity to do that. In addition, the state talks about how we allegedly come back 2, 3, and sometimes 4 times. The state routinely complains that we engage in piecemeal litigation. That's precisely what we were trying to avoid in this case. When we undertook Mr. Mulder's representation, it became clear to us at the outset that he was incompetent. Under Nevada Rules of Professional Conduct 1.14, we had an ethical obligation to take protective action on Mr. Mulder's behalf. So that's precisely what we did. Federal law said that incompetent individuals can't be forced to litigate their habeas petitions while they're incompetent. So ethically, we had an obligation to put that information before the court and demonstrate to the court that he was incompetent. The federal court agreed. He was incompetent. He couldn't assist us in that litigation. But once federal law changed and said, essentially, that we were forced to litigate with an incompetent client, we immediately sought leave of the court permission to come back, which between 2006 and 2012, the state consistently argued in capital cases we were not allowed to be in state court without permission of the federal courts. And the state courts were agreeing with that. Indeed, the judge in this case, Judge Leavitt, had held previously in another capital case that she was not going to proceed with the litigation of the state petition unless and until the federal petitioner obtained permission from the federal court. So we got the case. We exercised our ethical obligation to take protective action. The federal court agreed your client is incompetent. As soon as that stay was lifted, we sought permission to come back here, and we came back within 3 months. We came back with new information that isn't even in the federal petition because, again, Mr. Mulder had difficulty communicating, and it was only after working with one of our experts.
Well, counsel, I don't want to hijack the rest of your time. If Mr. Mulder is incompetent,
yes, sir.
How can counsel be ineffective for trying to communicate with him? If he's incompetent, he can't provide information. How can counsel be ineffective for failing to talk to the incompetent guy and try to get information that's not he's not going to give?
Your Honor, he's not a black box. He's not a vegetable. So there's some stuff in there. He has some memories. He has some ability to communicate. It's just that it takes more time. And as the district court noted at the 2005 competency proceeding where first state post-conviction counsel argued that Mr. Mulder was incompetent, the state court said, but counsel, you haven't even tried.
Excuse me, if I may, Justice Perigueri here in Carson City. I assume you were speaking of his deficits as far as the speech was concerned, and so therefore I assume he doesn't have any ability to communicate by written word. Is that correct?
His handwriting looks much like my 4-year-old son, and he often relies on other inmates. And if you look at the kites in the record, he often relies on other inmates to write on his behalf.
So how do those inmates communicate with him to be able to send a kite on his
behalf?
Your Honor,
he can speak.
Okay.
He can speak.
That was my question.
His speech is slow. It's labored.
That's entirely different than the picture that was painted, that he was unable to communicate with his counsel.
Your Honor, the federal court held that he is unable to meaningfully communicate, and that is true. He can communicate some things. He can't communicate complicated concepts. He can't communicate some memories because they're lost. But even the things that he does remember and he does understand, it takes him a long time. There's many times where he can't form the words that he wishes to say. And so it is because of these difficulties in communicating, not an inability, but a difficulty in communicating, that we believe that we can demonstrate good cause to overcome the default bars. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Thanks, counsel, for the arguments. The state that shed light on this particular fact of this matter will stand submitted.